Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with co-founder and CEO of Frame.io, Emery Wells. Now, Emery sold Frame to Adobe at the end of 2021 for nearly $1.3 billion. Emery and I talk about his journey to founding Frame, which included moving to New York without knowing anyone in the technology industry, working as a bartender for a number of years before founding a digital agency that worked alongside SNL to make their digital shorts. This led to Emery's recognition of the pain point that ultimately led to Frame. We talk about a number of different things related to operating a startup, including why Emery categorically rejects the lean startup concept and why he thinks it's done far more harm than good for businesses. We also talk about his near Jobsian obsession with design and getting into the details of almost everything he cared about while operating Frame. We also talk about what culture really is, including a near fatal experience that led to a cultural reset within Frame and ultimately set it on its course to its sale to Adobe. You'll hear that discussion with Emery here now. Emery, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So maybe for people that don't know, can you describe what Frame does?
Sure. So Frame.io is a video review and collaboration platform. At least that's where we started. We've expanded a little bit since then. But essentially, if you're a team working on video like this podcast here, you're recording a video, you go through an editorial and review process after we're done recording. And Frame is the platform that teams use to do that. So you can upload the work in progress edit, leave comments at different points in the video. You can draw and annotate on the frame. So really kind of everyone from Hollywood studios down to teams that are doing podcasts like this.
We use it all the time. Yeah. We were just talking before, I think Slack maybe is the thing we're in the most, but Rashad on our team, he said this would be the single tool. If it went down, it would ruin his week most. So I think that's a good place to be.
Yeah,
it means there's
responsibility,
stickiness to it.
Yeah, that's funny because I remember in the early days of pitching, the common thing that investors ask or think about or talk about is are you building a vitamin or a painkiller?
Yeah,
I think early days people were, I think there was a consensus with a lot of the early people I spoke to that it was it was a nice to have vitamin.
But, and then it gets embedded in the workflow, and probably in the early days too. I'd be interested, who are your initial customers? I assume VCs doing podcasts weren't in the TAM analysis originally. It was probably a lot of media and like agencies.
Yeah. I mean, I think our very earliest customers were a lot of kind of individuals and small teams that were making video, a lot of, small boutique post-production companies. And I think that media focused companies were our first enterprise customers. And then it's expanded to kind of like all sorts of people that make video.
You evolved this out of SNL in some ways. I realize the through line's not perfect, but maybe talk about the SNL digital shorts and how that came to be a part of Frame's founding journey.
Yeah, sure. So, I had a post-production company prior to Frame. So it was a boutique agency that did all kinds of post-production, did visual effects and color grading and finishing, mostly for broadcast advertising like commercials. And one of our clients was SNL. And so I used to do all the digital shorts for SNL. Did for 4 years or something. Everything that was pre-recorded for SNL is what they call their digital shorts. And that's their movie trailers and, fake commercials and music videos and things like that. So my company did the post-production for those. And I was working on those while building Frame, incubating Frame in my post-production company, amongst other things as well. But
I'm sure people remember a lot of those, like Andy Samberg and Lonely Island and all that stuff. What was the biggest one that it was already kind of going before your production in, right? So what was the biggest one you guys worked on that was kind of viral on the internet?
So I started working with SNL, the tail end of Andy Samberg's time. So they had already done the big viral
Lazy Sunday,
I'm on a boat. Those were the three early viral hits they did. But we did start working on them for so Dick in a Box wound up being a trilogy. There were three of them. So there was two more after that with
three
Andy
Dicks and Boxes.
It was I think the names were. One was called Mother Lover.
I remember that.
Another one called Not Gay in a Three Way.
Yeah.
There were some other big ones. There was there was there was one with Kristen Wiig called Red Flag that was a really a really big one.
Yeah, I remember all these.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like a dating one about like signs of red flags or something in the
Yeah, it was sex. She was like in a beautiful ballroom. It was like a perfume commercial.
That's right.
The perfume was called Red Flag.
That's right.
And they were talking about like, I don't know, you know what?
Different red flags. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I remember all that.
Like, her pinky fingernail is longer than all the rest. Red flag.
Did you get in with that group at all? Like, did you get to do after parties or go to any of the shows or anything?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I mean, there was. It was a tight group, and I was always invited to like the. So generally the way that it worked is. I mean, when the show was on airing, we were usually still working. So the whole nature of SNL is like so live. It's so last minute. The digital shorts, you think, well, they're pre-recorded. Like they probably do those well in advance. No, they don't. The schedule for those is they would shoot them on Thursday. So they would have, they would shoot them on Friday. So they would have their, I forget the exact schedule. Like they would have their writer pitch meeting on, I think Wednesdays was the pitch meeting. They would have one day, and that's when they would decide like what they were going to shoot, like of the things that were pitched. And then they would have one day of pre-production on Thursday. They would shoot on Friday, and they would air on Saturday, which means that we were working on them. Usually, you know, we were still, you know, putting the final touches on them when the show had already begun airing. So oftentimes, like, you know, you're delivering the final piece sometimes 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes before.
So are you on site? Because I'm just thinking file transfer times and all that. Like, how are you actually getting them the files?
Yeah. So no, we were, I had a, you know, my post-production company office, which was, you know, 15 blocks from where they were from, you know, from SNL. And, I would upload stuff. I would like FTP stuff to them. And then sometimes we would have like random slow internet days, and I would have an assistant that would like literally just like be running up the street
with like a USB,
with a hard drive and stuff. So we would ship hard drives. I would messenger hard drives, and then you know, for the main delivery, and then we would upload FTP stuff like last minute for like replacement shots or whatever. And then sometimes somebody would just, you know, have to like sprint up the street. So we were building Frame while we were doing all that work. I mean, that's the thing. I think Frame, you know, was very, very classic founding story of we built what we needed, and there was no question. There was like zero question in my mind what needed to be built. I knew that, you know, how we made video and our experience working with clients and back and forth, I knew that was completely universal, even though we were doing, you know, broadcast advertising. So very much a product that was built from, you know, a deep insight of doing the work and needing the product ourselves.
So normally I don't like to go linear in this, but you have an interesting, storied in New York. So you grew up in Miami, moved to New York, didn't do college. You were originally going to
skip
college.
Yeah.
And did you always have interest in media and entertainment, movies?
Well, I moved to New York with the intention of trying to be a filmmaker.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So that was the intention. And you bartended for a while when you were initially here. I guess any interesting things you learned about the service industry or like that made it into Frame from bartending?
Actually, I think that being in the service industry, I bartended for 3 years when I first moved here. So from like 20 to 20, I moved here when I was 20. So from like 20 to 23, I was bartending. And I think you learn a lot in the service industry. I mean, you know, I worked at, I'm sure you know it. I bartended at Bond Street Sushi. So I was, you know, in the lounge bartending. This was over 20 years ago. And, you know, you in the service industry, you learn to be of service.
Yeah.
You know, you say yes a lot, and you have to, you know, kind of, you know, cater to the people who you're serving. And that absolutely stayed with me for years. I mean, when I started my first post-production company, you know, I went from being a bartender to starting my first company, and I'd never worked in a company. In fact, I've still never basically worked in anyone else's company. Oh, I'm at Adobe now. But I brought that mentality into, you know, starting my post-production company, and doing a post-production company is a service business. And I would, you know, I think the thing that made me successful in the early days is I said yes to everything all the time. I can't remember a time I'd say no to a client. You know, whatever they asked me for, I said yes. And I don't think that's common. I think a lot of people are, you know, they bring their ego or their, I always said yes, no matter what it was. I said yes. And I did that for years and years and years, which meant, you know, my life was pretty tough for those years. I mean, I slept in that office, I don't know, thousands of nights.
Really?
Thousands of nights. Over the years, I mean, I had that company for almost 10 years, for eight years, I guess. So post-production, you know, it's a very 24-hour business. So the big post-production companies basically do run 24/7 because people are shooting, they drop stuff off late at night. It's like, I don't know, these things, the post-production companies really literally do run on a 24-hour schedule. There's a morning shift, a day shift, a night shift, an overnight shift at all these companies. And you know, I was in the beginning a company of one trying to compete with that stuff. So, I mean, I lived in that office. I slept because people would call, hey, we got this shoot. Can we drop off at 10 p.m.? You know, they'd call me at like 5 p.m. and I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem. And I'd stay there till 10 p.m. and they needed something the next morning. And I would just, you know, I would stay up all night and do it. And I did that hundreds and hundreds of nights.
Did you have an inkling of being a software entrepreneur while you were doing this? Or like, when did that start entering the consideration set?
Yeah, I always did. Because, you know, one of the areas of post-production that I got really into was visual effects. And the thing that I love about visual effects, which I think is very similar to software, is visual effects is deeply technical and deeply creative. It lives at the intersection. Depending on what type of visual effects you can do, eventually visual effects, by the way, becomes programming. I mean, you know, if you really get into like complex stuff. And so that was my entry point into coding. I mean, you know, you start by doing, you know, Python scripting, and then you have to build, you know, kind of more complex workflows. So my entry point into software was through visual effects. It is not full scale. I mean, at least what I was doing back then was certainly not full scale software engineering. But that was my entry point. And I always wanted to do software. I always, always, always wanted to do software. I think the opportunity arrived when I met my co-founder, and I hired my co-founder as an employee at my post-production company. And he had, he minored in computer science. I hired him right out of college. It was his first job. So he likes to tell people that his first interview ever was with me at my post-production company, and I hired him, and he never did another interview and has never worked anywhere else. So he likes telling that story. But he had a minor in computer science, and together we started tinkering on software, which ultimately led to doing Frame. But we did other stuff before that.
Was there a unique why now for Frame, like in the moment in time, or could it have been started a couple of years before? Could it have worked a couple of years later? Was there something special about when you actually got going?
I think a couple of years before would have been tricky. I think even you might argue that maybe a couple of years later maybe would have been better for Frame. But I think it was about the right moment in time. And it was, I think bandwidth played a role. Like you needed better bandwidth. Like video on the internet's gotten, you know, now it's commonplace, but just being able to like upload, move files, watch high resolution video, like all of that stuff. We launched Frame in 2015. So it was about the right time to, you know, to build a product like this. You basically needed, you know, video, like high bandwidth video to work on the internet, which it was pretty much working at that time. And you needed cheap storage. And so like for the workflows that we were doing and how much we needed to charge per month to make this a service that people would pay for and offer them enough storage to actually utilize it, that was probably around the right time. But I think that the first couple of years of Frame, I guess the only reason it would have maybe been better a few years later, and this might have only been true if some other players had come into the space, but we spent years kind of educating people about the problem. And back to the thing earlier about whether Frame was a painkiller or vitamin, it absolutely is a painkiller and has proven to be a painkiller. But you know, sometimes people don't realize the pain that they're living in until they take the painkiller, right? Like if you've just done things a certain way for a certain amount of time, because there literally was no other solution, you just sort of don't know that you're living in the pain. And then, you know, when the solution comes along, you realize that. So it took years of kind of educating the market.
At one point, you had tweeted a bunch of different lessons that you had learned or some things that were maybe contrary to popular opinion. And yeah. One of the ones that stood out to me was CEO shouldn't get caught up in the details. And you had said this is a myth. And if you consider leaders like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Brian Chesky, and the Collison brothers, all are/were deeply involved in the intricacies of their businesses. Can you speak to that point and how you were able to do that within Frame?
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of touched on this, but I think people have the idea that a CEO is supposed to do business stuff, and like I honestly don't even know what that means. It is the most important thing that your company does is build a product that your customers buy, and I think that, you know, it is the leader's job to, you know, to be deeply involved in creating that outcome. And I think the people who I think do, you know, incredible work and build the best products are the ones who are who know every single detail of what they're building and are deeply involved in it. Yeah, I mean, my experience of scaling Frame was that a lot of people around me told me I was doing it wrong. You know, because I would look at a design like, what, you know, CEOs aren't involved in designs, and or they're not involved in whatever it is that I was looking at. And you know, and I think in those days I was trying to, because I never built a software company, I never really scaled up like a large company. I was trying to listen and be like, maybe I shouldn't be like, is it weird? And everyone tells me like I shouldn't really be so involved. And I would listen to an extent, but instinctively I knew that I just knew there was no other job that was more important than manifesting the outcome that you give to your customers, and that only comes through details. There's not really a high level way of doing that.
I've read that you've said something about lean startups doing more harm than good.
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah.
That methodology. Maybe yeah. Can you speak to that? And I guess the derivative of how it informed your philosophy around Frame.
I read Lean Startup when everyone else did, and I, you know, this was before I had ever built any software. And I remember reading the book and thinking at the end of the book, like, wow, there's a magic formula that you can just like sort of like mathematically find your way, you know, to success.
A-B test your way
to success. And you know, I mean, I subscribed to like part of it for some time. But when I really started getting into building the company, you know, I think a lot of the people that we hired early on, where we were all young, I was young, I was inexperienced, we were hiring young, inexperienced people. And I think what young, inexperienced people do is they sort of like, you know, they like want to read what the internet's saying and try to follow those formulas. We had a lot of people that were, you know, really trying to kind of follow that lean startup methodology, which now, you know, sort of 10 years into building software and having an exit and everything, I fully reject lean startup as a methodology. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't like use data as, you know, one input into the decisions that you're making. But I think it really has done a lot of harm. I mean, here's my realization about lean startup is, years later I went back and I looked at by the way, I think Eric Ries is, you know, a really brilliant guy. I don't agree with his framework, but I went back years later after reading the book and I was like, man, I wonder what product Eric was building. Because he used his whole experience of Lean Startup was this game he was building. And I went back and looked at the product he was building. And it was an abomination. I mean, it was clearly something that was built by people that have absolutely no idea how to build a product. And Lean Startup was, you know, sort of like their mathematical approach to trying to build a product. And that was not their skill set. So, you know, it's equivalent to like teaching an artist how to paint by numbers. Like you can do that. You can try to like, you know, learn how to paint by numbers, or you can learn how to be an artist. And I think that product is an art. You know, I think that if you're a founder or a product person and you have this, you know, company that you want to build, I think you have to have really strong internal conviction, and you have to be able to see the world more clearly than everyone else. And yeah, like along the way, like you should have data kind of start, you know, kind of bump you, you know, 2 degrees this way and bump you 2 degrees that way. But if you have to use that sort of approach to building software, I don't think you're going to make it. And I think that I've seen a lot of the industry kind of turn and start to kind of evolve their thinking. Because what happened was Lean Startup just built tons of really bad products. They were too early. That was the other problem. You know, this whole idea of like getting the MVP out. And we've evolved since, I think the market in general, the industry in general has evolved past like what a lot of people maybe were misinterpreting, you know, the MVP approach, the minimum viable product, because people were just putting out products that were just not good, you know, and they're like, well, I guess it doesn't work. And it's like, well, no, it's just the product's not good. It's not fully baked. It, you know, it needs other things for people to love it and think that it's valuable. So, yeah, I mean, internal at Frame, we did spend a couple of years building it before we released it, but I don't know that was intention. I wasn't even thinking about it back then. That was just me and my co-founder, because we were the only two people who built the first version, and we spent about 2.5 years building it before we launched it.
Hmm. Did you pick some point in time in the future of what you needed the product to look like and just build to that? Was that the journey, or were you getting feedback incrementally from other people from the outside as you were going along?
We actually got no feedback.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's just, hey, I know this is what the market's going to need based on my experience, and let's go from there.
Yeah. We you know, a couple friends here and there, we would show it, but we didn't have any formal feedback for the first initial launch. It was like 2.5 years of building. And I don't think that, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. You certainly should. I think it depends on what kind of, like who, you know, what your founder market fit is. You know, I was building a product for myself in a problem space that I deeply understood. Which I think, by the way, is a very valid way of building. I think that building a product for yourself is a great way to build. Like, let yourself be customer number one. And I would still do that. If I were to do another company, maybe in a space I didn't understand as deeply, I probably would incorporate, you know, more customer feedback along the way. But no matter what product I build, I would try to make sure that I was customer number one, even if I wasn't the real customer. I think that you can try to like psychologically shift your mind and say, I'm going to be the customer now. And there's a real mind shift. And I even did this with Frame, even building Frame. There's a difference between a builder mindset and a user mindset. And even as the designer and the builder and the product thinker of Frame, I would have to very intentionally shift my mind and say, now I'm going to use it. Now I'm going to experience it. And I want to, you know, experience it from the mindset of a user. So no matter what I did, I would always put myself as customer number one, and I would have to be personally satisfied and sort of, you know, do I like using this product? Does it solve, you know, my problem when I'm in that user mindset?
Hmm. I heard you say something to the effect of as a company scales, it's inevitable that founders spend less time focusing on what really matters, which is product, and get more involved in process and all that.
Yeah.
Was that something that you made the mistake of getting more bogged down, or were you able to focus on product as number one throughout the journey?
Oh, I definitely got bogged down. And I think that, you know, one of the things that also I would hear a lot from kind of my own internal echo chamber, and I think that a lot of founders experience this, is that, you know, I think that a lot of the company, and again, I think we were all pretty young and inexperienced, but everyone thinks the founder should be this like business guy or girl, right? Like, as the founder, you have all these executive things that you should be doing, right? I don't even know what those things are. The only reason that a company exists is to build the product that it sells to its customers. And so I think that that should be the time that a founder spends, you know, the most amount of time on.
Hmm.
I definitely always stayed close, but you know, it got harder and harder to, I stayed close, but I think what got harder to do is maybe be a driver of the vision as, you know, the company scales, there's more people involved. And this gets to, you know, like, how do you set up like a culture around decision-making, and what's the founder's role in decision-making? Because, you know, people think that distributed decision making is another thing that should happen as you scale. I don't believe that. I think that as you scale, Distributed decision making is really just going to make everything substantially slower and worse. It doesn't mean that people don't have lots of responsibility, but you know, you need clarity of decision making and clarity of vision. If you think about all the best products out there, the ones that people universally love, the ones that's like, no question, everybody loves these products, whether it's software or hardware or whatever the case may be, there's probably a very good chance that those are the companies that are led by founders who really drive like that singular vision. Hmm. And the companies that do distributed decision making, probably less so. And I think this is, you know, I'll just say one other thing about this is, like, I'm not saying that there's one right way to run a company or build a company or whatever. And this was a key insight for me. I think that, you know, to build like a really world-class product, it requires, you know, a founder or a small group of people to be directly driving and making decisions. But there's obviously lots of companies that are not run that way that are incredibly successful. And there's just not one right way to do anything. You know, there's just like lots of paths up the mountain. The most important thing is that you build a company where everyone knows and understands what your path up the mountain is. Because if, you know, you have a group of people that think, no, we should do it this way, no, we should do it that way, and there's disagreement, that's when that definitely doesn't work.
Do you think that the point about having more centralized decisioning leading to better products, what do you think that is? Is it the consistency of the design and the experience? Is it just the more opinionated nature that you get from having a more narrow subset driving the vision?
Yeah, I think it's a couple things. One, I think that, you know, I mean, first of all, some people are better at making decisions than others, right? I mean, there's people that have, like, you need to find, rather than distributing decision-making, you need to find the people who have proven over time that they are best equipped to make a lot, you know, that they're best equipped to make decisions and be right a lot. And I think that's one of Jeff Bezos's like leadership principles, is that executives are right a lot. And the idea that everyone does that is just not true, right? We'd all have, if people were like, oh, you just distribute decision making and you'll have a lot of great outcomes. I think some people are better. So you got to find those people. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's always the founder. It's certainly not. But you got to find the people who are best equipped to make decisions. And then, yeah, I mean, when you have one person who's really thinking holistically, and again, this doesn't always have to be the founder, but somebody has to be thinking holistically with deep ownership about what every part of the product is going to do and how it works together. And inevitably, you know, when you distribute decision making, everyone has squads and they all have their areas of responsibility, and they, you know, they're trying to, you know, make great decisions for their areas, but they absolutely have a gazillion blind spots of, you know, every other product's every other team's responsibilities, and then how it all fits together as a whole. So, yeah, and then just generally somebody that has a really clear vision of what the future is supposed to be. And someone that can be thinking about the micro decision that you're making today on one small team and how that's going to evolve 3 years from that decision into, you know, wherever you're trying to get to.
Implicit to all this is an element of culture and how you define, you know, what it is that your business stands for. You guys went through a period of time where there was a little bit of a, I don't know if cultural crisis is the right way of articulating it, but if my research was correct, you had to fire your VP of engineering and then three directors of engineering, like, all resigned in the same day.
We did have some cultural crisis, and it was over a short period of time. But I mean, basically, we had three directors of Eng, which, by the way, you shouldn't have three.
No,
we had three directors of Eng that all left within a couple days of each other. Partially because we had some cultural crisis, partially because I had already hired a VP of Eng and that person didn't work out. And so, you know, that is a risk often, as you hire, you know, when you bring in an outside leader, sometimes the people who are doing the job don't like that new leader, and that can drive them out. I think there was definitely an element there, but overall, yeah, we did have some cultural crisis, and really was, you know, kind of a reset moment where that was a big turning point in the company's.
How far into the business, or how many people were you around then?
We were probably 60-ish people.
And so a couple years in.
Yeah,
and,
a couple years in.
And had you not been explicit about values? And
definitely had not been explicit about values. But here's the thing is, to me now, what culture is very, very, very clear. And it was something that I didn't understand for a long time. And I would always listen to people talk about it. And even still, I hear people talk about culture, and I don't think they describe culture in the right way. Culture is the political affiliation of your company or the religion of your company. You know, when you think about it, I like to think about it that way because it's much clearer, right? It's like when you think about a political affiliation, you're like, oh, it's a group of people that all have these like strong convictions and values about, you know, a certain way of thinking. And what we know is that, you know, two different political affiliations, like they cannot work together. And I don't know, I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but like you have to get a group of people that share the same, you know, political affiliation or religion. The same thing with religions. I mean, there's some very, you know, strong shared ideas in one religion, which would be not okay in another religion. So it has nothing to do with like, you know, what do you guys do for fun? And do you hang out after blah, blah, like that? That's not culture. Culture is, you know, what is the shared belief system about how you build, how you make decisions, et cetera, et cetera. And I, you know, I just, in the first couple of years of building Frame, in the very beginning, I had never even thought about this. Never even crossed my mind that, you know, like this was something I had to care about. And I thought, well, you know, you hire people and you're the boss and they'll sort of like follow your lead. And I didn't even understand that there was such a wide range of ways to like, I don't know, make this, it sounds silly thinking back on it. I didn't even understand there was such a wide range of ways to make decisions that could, you know, lead to so many disagreements. And so I wound up just, you know, hiring. Also, I was hiring kind of whoever I could get. This was, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017, I'd say kind of early in the, you know, sort of ZERP cycle. But you know, very hard to hire. I didn't have a network. I was, you know, you're hiring who you can get. And, but anyway, yeah, we wound up hiring people that just a large group. And it wasn't like there was just one sort of cultural ideology that existed at the company at that time. There was just a lot of different ideas. And it just led to a lot of internal debate, you know, in an unhealthy way. And so we did wind up having three directors that left in the course of a couple of days. And then, you know, maybe like a month or two later, I let go of the VP of Eng. And so at that point, it was kind of like a big reset moment where I had to take in everything that I'd learned and say, okay, well, how do we want to move forward? And there was three people I brought in at that time. I brought in a new head of Eng, a new head of product, and I brought in a chief of staff. And then later a new head of design. But really those three people at that time came in and you know, we really sat down and intentionally started kind of working on kind of repairing, you know, the culture and the team that was still there. We didn't really have that many people leave. It was actually, you know, those three directors left and most everyone stayed. It wasn't really like a big exodus. And that was the beginning of a new chapter.
Was that the group that ended up defining what the cultural values were?
Yeah.
And
that was essentially my leadership group through acquisition.
And so what did you find, I guess, in going through that process and coming up with the values? Was it things that you think everyone mostly agreed with within the company and you just needed to codify it and make it more explicit? Or were these more aspirational traits? Like how did you kind of go about actually assessing what the culture was?
Yeah, I don't think that culture. I think values need to be potent and come from, you know, one or a small group of people. I think with any type of, you know, decisions that you sort of like lay on people, you want to make people feel like they were part of the process. I think that's one of the, you know, that's like the magic is if you're going to set values, you want to set them yourself, but somehow make people feel like they set them or they were part of it. And so the way that we went about it is, and I had gone through, actually this is, we had gone through a few, so yes, we did sort of officially set values as part of this exercise. And I had previously tried to do like a value setting exercise where, you know, like we had polled, like that we'd sent out surveys and asked people like what they thought the values were and blah, blah, blah. I'd done it a couple different times. We never finished it because it was such a like, I don't know, it seemed unimportant, and two, the process that we were running to try to like set the values, we were just getting such watered down stuff. If you send out a survey to your company and you ask them for values, I promise you, you're not going to get
anything. Platitudes.
You get platitudes back. So the process that I wound up going through was we didn't have any, there's no values committee. There's certainly no committee. First of all, if there's ever a committee for almost anything, it's probably a bad idea, but there was no values committee. But what I did do is I reached out to like 15 or so people that were, who had been at the company for a while and I thought were kind of, you know, important figures in the company. And I asked them to just over Slack. I just said, hey, like we're working on values again. Can you please tell me like the one most important value to you personally, or like, you know, an idea or a principle or whatever that's most important to you? And when you ask one-on-one, there was nobody could see what these, you know, what someone else was thinking. And you said just for that one most kind of potent idea, I actually started getting some better stuff. So I think I wound up asking even more people, maybe asked like 25 people. And then I took all that and I sort of wordsmithed it and distilled it. And I actually had a lot of good ideas in that, but I could shape it into kind of, you know, what I wanted the values to be. And then I would go back to that person and say, hey, I interpreted it this way, or I shifted it this way. Does this still kind of align with, you know, the core idea of what you were thinking? And they say, yeah. And say, okay, well, will you be, you know, the kind of the spokesperson of this value? And so when we rolled it out, I didn't roll out the values. I had a group, I'd have like three people that would speak to each value that they had selected it. This was the most important idea to them. And so they got up in front of the company and said, you know, this is the value, this is an example, this is what it means. So really it was delivered, you know, as if it was all from the company. And if I'm being honest, it really was all from me. But you know, I think that's like a really important part of leadership, is you have to make, you have to have like clear, potent ideas. And it doesn't mean that people, they legitimately did
inform,
you know, those ideas. But I ultimately got to like shape that and have it be what I wanted the identity of our culture and values to be. It was really successful rollout. It took time, you know, like it took time to, you know, kind of work those into the fabric of the company. But we got there.
How many values did you end up landing with?
Nine.
Was there anything you did in the hiring process then subsequent to that to make sure you were like, did you have someone that was responsible for assessing singularly in an interview? Did this person map to those values,
or was kind of, I don't think I ever perfected that, to be honest. You know, we tried. I would continue experimenting with better ways of sussing that stuff out. But we certainly did like culture value interviews. The number one thing that I would do personally is, you know, over time you learn like what your more controversial ideas are, you know, the things that you get more pushback on and whatever. And I certainly had learned them in a couple years in. And when I would interview people, I would just unsell them. I would just say like, I would unsell them based on all the most controversial idea, you know, controversial things I'd learned about the way we operate, myself, and I would just unsell them on it and make sure that they're signing up.
Throw it all on the table and say, hey,
throw it all on
your
table. Yeah. Like one of the things that was just continue, you know, I'd say that I probably had I'm not comparing myself, but I had a Jobsian obsession with design. I am insane about design. I'm a maniac. I didn't know that about myself until I really got into it. And I have that maniacal, you know, obsession with wanting to have great design. I'm not saying I get there, but I certainly have the pursuit, right? I have the goal and the desire of getting there.
And how does that manifest itself for an individual employee in this case? Is it just constant iteration. I think the difference,
it's a lot of iteration. I mean, I think the difference between let's start with, like, there's, if you want to have the world's best design, it starts with, you need some people that are at least capable of reaching there from, like, a hard skills, you know, perspective. But let's just say that you have those people. Still getting to that, you know, kind of Apple level of execution creates, you know, requires a culture of deeply caring. And what deeply caring means is really, it's probably just iterating more than other people. Yeah. And not stopping when this is actually the key difference. It's the hardest thing about getting to, like, 11 out of 10. It's not even the work. It's pushing through the emotional boundaries of people thinking they've put in the work and we've reached the point where we're done. And it's pushing past those uncomfortable moments and doing it again. And then it's doing that 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 more times where people, they're like, you push people to their limits, right? And there's an art to that as well. Because there's a way of doing that where people just burn out and you know, don't like you at the end of the day. And there's a way of doing that where people get to the other side and say, wow, I didn't know we were going to get there.
Yeah, because you can do half the effort and get to some, to get to 95% of the outcome or something. But then you need that other half to get to the last 5% or whatever, which is unnatural. Yeah. Most people say, this is, will the customer actually ever notice this, or will they ever care on it? So in an interview process, was there any way of teasing that out? Or
I would tell people, especially with leaders, because I think I could be a little bit more open and direct with leaders. But I told people, one of the things that I would battle with is that, you know, I would hire people who would be really interested in Frame and think it was, like, a cool, exciting company to work at. They would, one of the things you'd always say, oh yeah, we love the brand and the attention to detail and the design and everything. And then they would come in and be in opposition to the very things that created those outcomes, and often had the experience of, like, why would somebody come in and say, we want to make the company worse, we want to pull it down, you know? And so I would tell leaders, and this is something I did, you know, only kind of a few years in, but I'd say the one thing that you can never, ever do, and I just want to be really clear, is that if you ever lower my standards, we're not working together. Your job is to come in and raise my standards. I want you to pull me up. Like, you should be pulling us, you know, getting us higher. And it was hard because my standards are really high, but that was one of the things that I would tell leaders. And it is probably one of the things that is, like, you know, where I get probably would make someone incompatible to work with me if they try to lower the standards.
The best employees at Frame, if you were to go run it back and start another company, was there a shared characteristic that stood out for the people that you had the most success with?
Yeah, I like working with people that have high pain tolerance. And, you know, I think that, like, on the journey to great, you know, and doing great things, I think you need really high pain tolerance. Mm. I remember that tweet I shared about pain tolerance. I deeply believe that. I mean, I want to work with people that have a high tolerance for pain. And I remember when I tweeted that, people said, yeah, well, like, pain tolerance sounds painful. You could say, like, you know, why don't you say, I don't know, what were people trying to rephrase it as? Because it sounds like you're just, like, rephrasing it in a nicer way.
Like a willingness to do their best or
something. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, if it's uncomfortable to you to hear pain tolerance, that's one of the things we look for, that means you don't have a high pain tolerance.
Yeah.
Like, if you have to, like, soften it to make it okay, then I'm sorry to say you don't have a high pain tolerance.
Some of the most important things about values that I found is the opposite also... If the opposite also isn't true, it's a platitude. It's everyone will agree for it. If you can't frame the counterbalancing thing in a positive way, then what you're saying is probably hollow in some way. And so having high pain tolerance, there's probably, like, there's an opposite version of that, of, you know, being inclusive or empathetic to other people's feel. There's some version of that that's probably also true. And you want people to opt into your way of doing things. If it's true for every person or the majority of people in the population, then you're not discerning or you're not getting people to opt in some specific way.
Yeah.
Is the design side of doing building product, was that, when you think about what motivates you and what drove you through the ups and downs of, how long was the journey? 7 years before selling to Adobe, and now you're 9-ish?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Was design what you came back to as the thing that most motivated you and most drove you through it, or was there some other element of building a company?
It was probably definitely design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you got more and more senior within the or as the company got bigger, you stayed the same, but your responsibilities started to become more dispersed. Was there a structural way that you maintained responsibility for design so that it didn't start to be decentralized?
No, I think it was something I struggled with. I mean, I did wind up, hiring some really good people in the design organization, which they brought a lot of intensity to design. And so, yeah, I mean, naturally when you scale, I mean, you just, it's impossible to be involved in, every minute little detail. But the thing that, so one of the big turning points that we did, and something that was really critical for my continued involvement in not just design, but product and just kind of overall high quality execution. After we had the big reset moment and we brought in these new leaders, and then shortly after that, we brought in a head of design. So we had this new leadership team, and, my objective with them was we want to really elevate the quality of our execution. And so we set up, a pretty simple framework, where we would have on Fridays, we would have what we called, stakeholder reviews, which were, sessions to kind of review the work. But let me back up, if there's ever a problem within a company, and this is super common, right? You're you sort of expect something of the team and they deliver something else, right? That's just one of the most common things you can experience as a leader. I have developed what I think is a pretty straightforward, simple framework. And these are ideas that are not new. They probably exist in every management framework. It's just that management frameworks have a lot more steps that I don't think about. So I just use three things, which is the key to changing anything is you just have to sort of align on expectations. What does success mean? If we were to all say, yeah, we knocked it out of the park, what does that look like? And the more detailed you can be, the better, right? Write it down in excruciating detail. And then get everyone to sign up, sign up for it and say, yep, we all understand that this is what success looks like. Because now you have this thing you can all point to. If you ever stray from it, you have this shared understanding of expectations. So expectations is one. The second is accountability. How do you hold people accountable, or how do you ensure that that people are aligning to those expectations? You have to do check-ins. You have to do inspections. A favorite quote of mine that I did not come up with is that people do what you inspect, not what you expect. And so if you're not inspecting the expectations, I don't think through some process in the organization, I don't think you're ever going to get there. And then the third thing is actually the accountability or the action. What happens if somebody is not meeting those expectations, right? You've aligned on them. You set it, you check in to make sure that they're happening. Now what happens when they're not happening? And obviously firing somebody is the most extreme thing you can do, but usually that's not the right tool that's a last resort tool. And so for us, what we did is we set up these stakeholder reviews. They were held every Friday. We basically took all of Friday, and we had every single team had a slot on Friday they could use to present work. But, sometimes they weren't ready to present, and so they didn't have to use the slot. But when they did have a piece of work that was ready to present, they would use these slots. And so as we were trying to change the kind of internal expectation of what we were delivering, one of the things I did when we rolled out this program is that prior to the Friday presentations, the teams would come in and they would present their work. I would have my leadership team do a pre-inspection of the presentation. And in this case, let me just clarify. We had two types of meetings. We had what we called a stakeholder review, and that was they could present, you know, a work in progress design or kind of anything to get feedback. And then we had something called a build review, which was like, this was a finished unit of work and it had to meet every expectation that our, you know, that meets kind of our shipping criteria and what customers would experience. And so importantly for this build review, you know, I don't know how many times you've been in a meeting, and I'm sure founders can relate to this. You're sort of, the team is doing the demo of the thing they're going to ship, but there's like always a caveat. There's like 10 caveats. It's like, okay, well, yeah, so there's this, we're still working on this one thing. And it's like, this meeting was to say no caveats. At what point do we have the thing that's going to be the thing that our customers use? And that's what this meeting was for. And so my leadership team would do a pre-inspection of the work to make sure that it met the criteria. And one of those criteria, among many, was that, you know, the execution of the build had to be pixel perfect. And so that what pixel perfect meant was, you know, not 99.9% accurate, but 100% accurate. So that meant if one pixel was misaligned or not centered or whatever the case may be, we actually would cancel the meeting. And that seems like kind of like not a big deal, right? Like it's not like it's certainly not the same as firing somebody, but it actually was a really big deal. And because what it meant is when we rolled out these, you know, kind of the expectations in this new program, the builder views, we canceled these meetings for months. I wouldn't look at the work for months and months and months. The meetings were canceled, and it created a lot of tension on the teams, a lot of tension internally. But eventually, you know, we the team had to build the muscle, and all collectively we had to build the muscle, and which ultimately kind of became part of our, you know, culture, I'd say, that this is what it meant to ship product at Frame. And after those, you know, sort of 3-4 months of pain, I mean, I'd say that just like across the board radically shifted our quality of execution up. And I think after those 3-4 months, I don't think I've ever seen a pixel off. I don't think, like in like years, I don't think you just, you know, and it's one of those things like you experience with Apple, and it's not to say that Apple's perfect, but one thing that you know you'll get with Apple is like, shit's going to be like 100%.
Yeah, polished.
It's going to be polished, right? And yeah, maybe there's other things they didn't get right or idea, but like there is a quality of execution that is just fundamental. Like they can't, nothing will ever come out of that company that doesn't have that veneer of polish. And that's even just that. Forget about like all the foundational decisions underneath that. That's really, really, really hard to do culturally and at scale. And so we got there, and that whole kind of builder view, I think it was cumbersome on the teams. I don't think the teams always loved it.
I would imagine getting their meeting canceled was it?
But just overall, I think, you know, it was cumbersome on the teams. We actually wound up getting rid of them as we were trying to accelerate our speed of execution after working on quality of execution. Then we worked on speed of execution. And one of the things we tried when we were trying to accelerate our speed of execution was to get rid of those meetings, because teams wound up putting a lot of prep time. You know, it's one of those things like when a team is presenting to a leader, an executive, or the CEO, you know, even if you don't want them to put a lot of prep time, you're like, hey, just show me what you're doing. It's impossible.
Yeah.
They will spend days and days. They spend so much time. And I've experienced this, like now being at Adobe and I'm not the CEO and I'm not the boss. And, you know, I have to go and present, you know, to senior leadership or to Shantanu, the CEO. And you're just like, gosh, I can't just roll in. Even if their expectations are different, you feel like you're not doing your job. If you don't show up like buttoned up professional presentation, it's designed well, the whole thing. And like, you know, sometimes that's necessary, but a lot of times it's not. And anyway, we tried getting rid of our kind of review process, and I don't think it really accelerated us.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think it accelerated us. And I think that there was a hit in like that. Quality. That was like these gates that ensured we were always shipping
the quality.
Yeah.
Brand is an interesting thing for B2B companies. I think you guys were pretty purposeful about the brand of Frame. How did you think about going about building a brand in the B2B world?
You know, I didn't think about it a lot, other than the fact that I think I probably just instinctually built Frame I wanted to make it cool, number one. Like, I wanted to make it cool. I wanted to make it a desirable brand. I had never worked in enterprise software prior to launching Frame. I had really never bought enterprise software because I had a small boutique agency. Any software I ever bought was just, you know, something I could sign up with a credit card myself. And I think I built Frame overall, from the brand to the product and everything. We started by building Frame in the way that, like, I don't know, I would use it, buy it, etc. And so we had this kind of very kind of more consumer looking motion, you know, from sign up with a credit card, self-serve, focused on brand. But I've come to evolve my thinking. And I think there's people who think, you know, maybe brand is not a worthwhile effort in enterprise software. Design's not a worthwhile effort in enterprise software. I mean, I've shared tweets around, you know, how there's such an opportunity in enterprise software. If you just come in like high quality execution, you can basically just win in any vertical. And there's people that are just like hundreds of comments of people saying, nobody cares about the product. Nobody cares about quality. Nobody cares about design. Like, that's not going to matter to the buyer. And I'm like, guys, this is why enterprise software sucks. You know, because there's a belief system that whether, you know, a brand doesn't matter, design doesn't matter, you know, quality of execution doesn't matter in enterprise software. And I think that that might have been truer, you know, earlier. But I think today, where one, we've seen this big shift in the consumerization of enterprise software. And what does that mean? It means that, like, I think people's expectations of what software is just different, right? Like, we all use much more high quality software. And whether you're using software at work or using, you know, Instagram on your phone, you just have like an expectation of what good software is. And I think the end user within organizations has a bigger voice than they've had, you know, than they've had before. Like, whether it's IT or, you know, whoever's making the buying decision, they're much more careful about buying something that their users are going to hate or not use. And so I think there's just been this big kind of consumerization of enterprise software. Anyway, you originally asked me about brand. We built a brand because it's just fun for me, really. And I don't know if it's like, this is what I'd say. I think that anecdotally, I think that our brand, both our go-to-market motion and our brand, probably made it a lot easier to start enterprise conversations.
Mm. Was it just an outgrowth of your own style and personality, or were there frameworks or methodologies that you used of how to actually actionableize what the brand was and what you wanted people to feel, or was that just more innate to you?
I think it was probably more innate. And you know, my background was in post-production and production and post-production and filmmaking, and so I just, you know, I'd want to use that tool set as well. Like, we were able to do stuff that, you know, maybe less expensively than it would, you know, than someone else could do it, because we, you know, I just literally had done that work for years and knew the freelancers and the people to hire and things like that. So yeah, I think it was more innate.
You have a methodology or a style of launching twice, doing a pre-announcement and then an announcement. Can you talk about that and what the benefits of it are?
Yeah, I think that you just basically want to milk a launch for everything that, you know, for as much as you can. And for most of our launches, we would do a teaser. So you want to let people know that it's coming. And a lot of people do this, but I think we would, you know, maybe milk it a little bit more. So you do you do some kind of teaser where you get people excited and let them know that it's coming. And there's lots of ways to sort of maximize, you know, that experience. I'd say, like, if I go back all the way back to our, like, actually launching Frame for the first time, and we use the same framework for subsequent launches, but we would do a we do this sort of like an announcement launch and you know, build a landing page and experience and a teaser video, and then, you know, we would build, you know, lots of kind of gamification around you know, like, if I go all the way back to the original launch, this is before anybody had access to Frame, and I'm sure we've all seen, like, these gamified launches. I guess you see less of them now, to be honest, but you know, back in 2015 was like the era of gamified launches. And so what we did is we you know, we had a landing page that wasn't just any landing page. Like, we put a lot of effort into creating like an experience of a landing page. And most people, you know, when they're launching something, it's like, hey, drop your email in, right? And then to get notified when it's going to be ready. And that's sort of the end of the journey. But I think that's a missed opportunity, because when people are interested and engaged and excited and wanting access to something, you can usually get them sort of do more things on your behalf. So in the earliest launch, we had this landing page where you could drop your email, get notified when it's ready. But then as soon as you put your email in, we kind of took you through this whole gamified journey where we had like a point system, and we said you can do this for 5 points and this for 5 points and this for 5 points. And the more points you gain, the earlier, you know, like kind of you raise your ranks in terms of getting access.
Some of them are like, if you send this email and share with five other people that sign up.
It was shared on social. I think we had back then Twitter and Facebook. So you got points for sharing on social. You got points for, I think you could add friends' email addresses in. You got bonus points for, you had to answer a survey. It was like 5 questions. And then you got bonus points for following us on social. And we had like 15,000 people go through that flow. This was when we were literally zero, no one. I mean, you know, it was just me and my, this was our earliest launch. It was me and my co-founder. Had no one else that were helping us. And that early launch got like 15,000 people to sign up. And
what do you think? I mean, were you previewing on the landing page what Frame was? And so
we were previewing what made it work, what made sort of the viral loop work was, we seeded it with, it did just like kind of grassroots marketing. Like, you know, we come from the industry. So my previous industry was in post-production. So knew all those people in the industry. And identified, you know, people that were kind of influencers. That word didn't exist in 2015, I don't think, like commonly, but, you know, that we identified people that, you know, had a following and asked them. We just asked them, hey, will you, I mean, like people, I don't think people were getting paid to do kind of influencer stuff in 2015. I think, so we just like asked people, hey, would you, you know, we're launching this thing, would love your support, would you share this? And so we seeded the sharing with, I don't know, 50, 75 people that would, you know, share the announcement on Twitter. And then obviously we did trade press, and we actually were on the front page of Hacker News, because we were using a front end framework that was new at the time for the landing page called Famous. It was this like front end framework, JavaScript framework that was supposed to like their mission was to sort of build once, run anywhere, and do like, you know, iOS level animation on the web. We wound up using it for the landing page, not for the whole product, but just because we were using that framework, we were front page on Hacker News. And I think that, you know, that got some, actually probably got more like Silicon Valley types of investors, potential investors, that's where they found us on Hacker News. We were also on an early version of Product Hunt, like when it was back as an email distribution list. But it was all just through these like organic seeding and then the social sharing flows, and it just kind of worked, right? So like somebody would tweet it, and then another person would see it. They'd go, they'd sign up, they'd tweet it, and we got that loop going. So we had 15,000 people sign up for that initial launch.
And you also did personal touch, like automated follow-ups. You would reach out after 15 minutes or something to someone?
Yeah, that was really important as well. So you'd sign up, and then you would get an automated email from me 15 minutes after. And I think a lot of people do this now. But the email that you got from me 15 minutes after signing up was totally plain text. There was no unsubscribe, which I know technically is, you know, you're not supposed to do that. But I was really trying to make it look like it was an email that I wrote, and it was super plain language. It was like 2 sentences, I think. It was like, hey, I just noticed you signed up. You know, what interested you in Frame? What pain points do you have? And I got thousands and thousands of responses, which I went through every single one of them. And I went through and read every single one of them. And that was, and in them, there were like, you know, there were potential future enterprise customers. There were investors. And the one of those emails was from Balaji at Andreessen. He was at Andreessen Horowitz at the time. And that was like first contact with Silicon Valley. I was a total outsider. Yeah. I didn't know a soul. I didn't know an engineer. I didn't know a founder. I didn't know a venture capitalist. I knew zero people. And sort of like my first contact with Silicon Valley was this email from Balaji. And I remember getting that first email, and I'm a pretty mellow guy. I don't really like show a lot of visible excitement, but I was, you know, I couldn't believe that it was an investor who was voicing interest, and it was from Andreessen Horowitz. And I was like, oh, like bingo. Of course I responded, and that led to an introduction to somebody. He introduced me to Steven Sinofsky, but that automatic response email, you really kind of like opened up these conversations with VCs.
What did you learn about fundraising? So you went in and met Andreessen in the early days, pre-product fully launched.
We had this launch that I just told you the story about. That was an announcement launch. The product was not ready to use, and So Balaji, responded to that email from Balaji, and he, he said, not really my space, but I think, but I'd like to meet my colleague, which was Steven Sinofsky. And so I went in, my first contact in person, or really, I guess at that point, other than that conversation with Balaji, my second conversation with anyone in Silicon Valley was Steven Sinofsky. And for those listening, I think most people know, but Steven was the president of Windows at Microsoft. He had left Microsoft, and he was now at Andreessen. So that was, I came in and I, had a conversation with Steven, which did lead to a board pitch at Andreessen, some weeks after that, but they did not invest. But you asked me what I learned about pitching. There was a really important thing I learned about pitching, which was, when I came in, first conversation with Steven, he kind of knew a little bit about the industry and the space, so he did get it. But, my original pitches, I think we're all bad. And one of the things I noticed is that if you were to sit down and ask me, hey, tell me about Frame, tell me about the story, like on a phone call or just like casually, whatever, I would tell you a story of who I am, what I'm doing, and why it matters. And then I looked at my pitch, and it's like, well, the pitch looked very different. And so basically my realization was, if somebody just asks me about Frame when I'm not doing like a pitch with a deck, I'm able to tell a really compelling story, but my pitch isn't there. So, one of the conversations I had upcoming with an investor who had reached out, typically, and when you make first contact, you're like, oh, so tell me the story, right? You're just like, tell me about what you're doing. And I knew that my storytelling that I just would do off the cuff, I couldn't like recreate. I couldn't sit down and think about it and recreate it. Like, you just have to do it. There's something about, I have a job where I'm communicating to a human this thing that I need to tell, and your brain just like works differently. So I recorded my conversation with this investor, just my side of me pitching my story. And then I took that recording, and I'm like, okay, this is the narrative. This is the framework. So I took the story, and then I made I put slides to the story, which I think other people, I've done this a lot now. Like, I always just want to first, like, let me just like talk and tell a story. If I'm doing a presentation, I try to just talk and tell a story. And sometimes I would do that, with my chief of staff, I would, dictate and talk about what thing I wanted to tell, and then go back after I had that story and start working on how the pitch and the slide deck sort of aligns to it. And that made my pitch like infinitely better.
Rather than people inevitably speak to slides. They just kind of go slide by slide through it. And ultimately, oftentimes slides are an amalgamation of a bunch of people's thoughts and feedback all going into some version of it versus what you naturally want to communicate. In the early days, you got an acquisition offer for like $10 million.
Oh, this is a great story. Yeah.
Why? What made you say no to doing that?
The first two people I ever made contact with was firstly, it was the Balaji that got introduced to Steven Sinofsky, and the third or second person was Aaron Levy from Box, and he had also responded to that autoresponder. He saw it, wherever he saw it, he responded. He's like, hey, Aaron Levy here, think what you're doing is really cool. So when I flew out to San Francisco, which, you know, by the way, when I flew out to meet Steven, when I flew out to meet Aaron, they weren't like, hey, come out to meet. I'm just like, hey, I'm going to be out there these dates if you want to meet. And I'm like, I'm no reason to be out
there.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, I'm not here. And I'm like, actually, it's these other dates. I'm going to be here.
Yeah.
So I misspoke.
Anyway, right. So I went out and I think actually, I'm trying to think if I, what was it? Was, did I meet Aaron first or did I meet Steven Sanofsky first? I forget which one, but I went out same trip. And anyway, you know, Aaron was interested in what we were building. And I met him for dinner at Fuki Sushi on El Camino near the Box headquarters back then. I think they moved. And he brought like his whole executive team too. And we had this like long, my first contact with, I think I'd maybe had a phone call with him prior. I don't remember, but we had this like long dinner. And then after dinner, we went back to Box HQ and I gave him a demo of what we had. This was all pre-launch. We hadn't launched anything. It was pre-launch. Gave him a demo of what we had built, and that kicked off a series of conversations with Aaron, who, you know, I think was really kind of interesting. You know, Aaron's background, I think he's, you know, famously was like an intern at like a movie studio, I forget, like Universal or somewhere, and he'd always had this interest in filmmaking, and I think saw the angle for kind of what we were doing and how that fit into Box. So it kicked off a series of conversations, and you know, I loved getting to know Aaron. He's a great dude and someone I've stayed in touch with over the years. But it did ultimately culminate. Like I knew, you know, the nature of the conversations were like leading towards some conversation around an acquisition, and we had met, you know, I don't know, four or five times, different scenarios. And I kept thinking, you know, it's actually funny as I think back about these conversations with Aaron, I really only had two, I guess kind of serious acquisition dances. I had interest along the way of the years, but nothing that was like really real. It's funny as I think back about these conversations with Aaron, it was similar to, acquisition conversations with Scott Belsky, where there is a dance, you know, like
Scott's at Adobe who ultimately acquired.
Scott Belsky's at Adobe who ultimately acquired. There's a dance where you're getting to know someone, and, you know, thinking back to those early conversations with Aaron, we had met like, you know, four or five times, and I'm like, you know, I remember thinking that I'm like, gosh, the next conversation, it's got to lead to an offer, right? Because the first you're kind of getting to know each other and all these things. And so I remember, after, you know, several meetings with Aaron, we had a meeting scheduled. I was back in New York. I'd met him a couple times in San Francisco. He was in New York. We met somewhere in New York. We had a call scheduled. It was like late my time. It was, I don't know, 10, 11 p.m. my time. And I'm like, okay, there's only one thing we could possibly talk about on this call. It's got to be an offer. And prior to that call, I called my co-founder and I said, okay, look, Aaron's going to call me. I think there's got to be an offer, right? So like, I want you and me to be aligned on like, what's our buy it now price.
And by the way, are you dual processing with VCs at this point? Or are you self-funding as this is going on?
I was just self-funding. I was dual processing with VCs. We didn't wind up actually getting, we were not able to raise until after we had actually launched the product. And then we had a lot of early traction and everything. But yeah, I called my co-founder before the call with Aaron. I was like, I just want to be aligned. Like, what's our buy it now price? And I think, honestly, I don't remember what our buy it now price was, but it was something like north of $20 million or something like that. And mind you, this was pre-launch, you know, like it was just he and I, and yeah, I had a company that was doing well, but like that would have been a lot of money for me back then, for all of us, for anybody. And so Aaron called and, you know, we're having our back and forth, we're talking and I'm just like, hey, I just got to get to the thing. Like, yeah, when's it going to come out? And I think he'd offered like, you know, $1 million, was the opening bid. And I told this story before. And so like, I want to be consistent as I tell this story. I think I've told it like on an interview before, but I don't remember what number I countered with, but it was an absurdly high number. Like, yeah, it was a number that, you know, he was just inappropriate to
I mean,
counter
like
with
30 or
I
like
think it was like 50 or yeah. something like that, you know, like something stupid. And you know, I think his, I remember his response was like, his response was funny because he's, you know, he's a very funny guy.
Yeah, totally.
He always, he's, he's always got a great joke. And he was just like, his response was like, God damn it. You really are a founder. And, yeah. So it, I think that, yeah, he, in that conversation, he was, you know, he was pretty, I think we got in that, on that phone call, he got up to a verbal, like, he's like, look, there's the highest number that we could ever acquire a company for. That's like a pre-launch company with two people. Is $10 million. Like the board would never allow me to do anything above that. And it's just probably wouldn't, you know? And so we, and I don't even know that that was like an offer for 10. It was just basically like kind of setting a,
just so you know,
demarcation this is,
But you used that and that was the anchor for the seed round, right? That was the
I used that and I so that was my anchor for the seed round when I pitched Andreessen and then later Accel, and that was our valuation. So we did our, you know, we raised $2.2 million in a seed round and $10 million pre. So I used that as our anchor for the valuation.
Flash forward all the way to the actual acquisition. So how did all that come to be with Adobe?
It started off with a DM on X, then Twitter, still the Twitter back then, from Scott Belsky, who... he just sent me a DM on Twitter like saying, hey, you know, been following you guys, would be great to connect. And I knew getting the DM from him already was, you know, I think I sort of right off the bat kind of knew like, okay, this is probably going to lead to some kind of interest in a conversation around acquisition because
is this the end of 2020, beginning of 21?
It is the beginning of 2021. So I think it was, March of 2021 when he reached out the first
kind of surprised contact. You guys didn't know each other.
Well, that's what I was going to say is that, you know, I mean, one is Scott is, you know, a really prolific investor. He's, you know, really prominent, you know, figure in the industry.
You guys are both in New York,
both in the same space. Yeah. But yeah, so I had 15 people along, you know, over the years had offered to introduce me to Scott, and I always said yes. I was like, yeah, yeah, because every person I would talk to, every VC I would talk to, like, hell, you know who you should talk to?
Yeah.
He's like, do you know Scott? Yeah. You should talk to Scott. And I'm like, great, I'll talk to Scott. But then it would always just go silent. So, you know, I think on the other side, Scott was like, nah, you know, because he was at Adobe and they're basically, you know, they were competitive, right? So he didn't, Scott doesn't invest in competitive companies and things like that, right? So I never met him, but then he reached out over DM and that kicked off, you know, a series of conversations similarly to the Aaron conversation, so, you know, series of conversations where it was like lots of getting to know each other, lots of walks in the park, there's a lot of, you know, over a period of a couple months, before we got to maybe not a couple months. It was like, probably 6 weeks from initial contact to negotiating a verbal offer.
Mentally, at that point in time, you're running a business and you're planning for a subsequent fundraise, an IPO, whatever the things are. And then there's this orthogonal...
Well, we were actually closing our Series D. So it was close to $100 million Series D that was all being done by our insiders, our existing investors, when the conversations started. And Scott actually convinced me to pause the closing to see if there was a path to acquisition.
That would have been a very unnecessary, dilutive amount of capital taken.
And I think, one, my board was supportive. You know, they were supportive of pausing the round. So we did pause it. And we did pause it for a little bit, but we reached a point in the negotiation where we felt like we were probably too far apart on valuation. And so, you know, I had basically thanked Scott and, you know, just kind of said, hey, like after we eventually did get to that first offer, I said, hey, I think the offer is indicative that we just have more work to do. And so I'm going to close the round and, you know, maybe we'll, you know, there'll be an opportunity to speak in the future. And that was my true intention. I was like, because I talked about it with the board and it's, you know, I needed to capitalize the business. Like we needed to get this round done, and I had been holding it for a while. So I reached out to, my lawyers at the time. Was Gunderson was the team we worked with. And I told them, like, we're good to go, like, send out the wire information. And I think this was, it was a Friday. And I told Gunderson to send out the wire information. But then I got another follow-up call from Scott, and he was like, he's like, Emery, don't do it. It's like, just give me 24 hours. Give me one more day. And so I called the lawyer back. I was like, hey, did you send the wire information out yet? Don't send it. He's like, I was just about to send the email. I was like, don't send it. So we paused it for one more day. And then it was that next day that we wound up, having our verbal agreement.
Was it hard through that period of time to have these two things going on?
Oh, it sucks. It's really hard. Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, because, you know, the full acquisition took from first contact in April to closing in October. And during that time, you know, I was spending 90%. I was spending 95% of my time on the acquisition and, you know, 5% on the business. And then as things progressed and we got to the LOI and we signed it, then you have to pull in more people, and, like, you know, diligence is intense. Diligence for an acquisition, I mean, I've only gone through one, so I don't know what other acquisitions are, but, you know, it's like a venture capital diligence, you know, but like times 100. I mean, it's just like it was intense. We also, as part of the acquisition, we had never done an audit, and, you know, OW being a publicly traded company, they required that we complete a 3-year audit. And to do a 3-year audit in the course of like a 6-week diligence period, which normally a 3-year audit, you know, I'm told would take, you could spend like 6-8 months, even longer, just depending on like how much time you want to spend on it. Like we did a 3-year audit in about 8 weeks. Which was intense. I mean, like, it is, you know, you are digging up, I mean, the amount of crap you got to dig up, like some random receipt that, like, you know, the auditors pull out some random charge and you're like trying to find some receipt. Cause, you know, in the early days you have like people are just spending on credit cards and whatever. Anyway, yeah, it's intense. I mean, that was by far the most intense period of the entire journey, was trying to do the acquisition while continuing to run the business. Also, the business was going through its steepest growth inflection point at that time. But yeah, it was, I mean, I would do like a, you know, because we were trying to run the business, and the my leadership team had all their normal responsibilities. We would start with a exec team morning huddle at 8 a.m. And then, of course, we're in New York, Adobe's in San Francisco, and our bankers, we were using Catalyst, who were based in San Francisco. And a lot of times Adobe would have like their acquisition update meeting around like 6-7 p.m. or something like that, usually late. And then, so that was already even later in New York. And then, you know, my team at Catalyst would usually like have dinner with their family. Anyway, I would talk to Catalyst in the evenings at like 11 p.m. midnight. And then we were just dealing with all of the diligence stuff like throughout the whole day. So, and I did that for, you know, 6 months. It was intense.
Is there anything you would have done differently in the process, or if you were advising a founder to be prepared for something that could be, I mean, this is the outcome for 99.9999% of companies, maybe audit sooner. I don't know what.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of stuff you can do just hygiene wise that, you know, if I were doing differently, I would just know to, you know, have a little bit of better hygiene about. Yeah, you should do an audit. You should probably do, you know, a yearly audit. I think I've sort of purged a lot of this from my mind.
There's some trauma compartment in there.
Yeah.
Put you on a couch over here. Yeah.
But no, there is, I'd have to sit down and think about it. There's a number of things from a hygiene perspective, like, just keep, you know, like keep all your, just like your enterprise contracts, keeping those, like making sure that like you actually have like every executed, signed, like, you know, signed both sides, the final executed contract, like, you know, in your Salesforce database along with the bubble. Just like, you just got to have good hygiene. Like you got to, I mean, we're a little messy. Like
we're a startup.
Yeah. We couldn't find some of our fully executed contracts, you know, like their side signed, but then we didn't have our counter signed and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Just a lot of little stuff.
A lot of little stuff.
On the way. Was there something unique at that moment in time that you felt like it was going to be a good partnership with Adobe versus going on your own? Or did they just end up making the compelling offer that made it worthwhile for everyone involved?
No, it was definitely, I mean, I think a big part of moving forward was Scott. You know, Scott Belsky is a really, he's just a really good person. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
And anybody that knows him would all say that he's like a good, kind, honest, but he's the type of person you're like, oh, I want to work with Scott. You know, like he's super likable. And he's a startup guy. His company, Behance, was acquired by Adobe. And so he was able to really relate and tell me about his journey of Behance being acquired by Adobe. He was also really transparent about the things he was trying to change at Adobe, the things that he was like, hey, these are the things that, you know, I think we're not good at, and you know, we're trying to change, and you know, would love your help with it, and blah blah blah. So I think a big part of the deal happened, I mean, no, first of all, like the reason the deal happened was Scott. I mean, he sponsored the deal, sold me on it, sold it internally, and so yeah, I mean, the deal happened because of Scott in a lot of ways, in more ways than one. But for me personally, yeah, he really sold me on it. And I think I looked at it as Adobe was the natural home for Frame. We didn't have a lot of natural acquirers. You know, there's always a random Amazon somehow thinks they should be involved. But in terms of a company that's this is in their wheelhouse, what they do, Adobe was the company.
Yeah. So it just made sense. That makes sense.
Maybe Autodesk a little bit, you know, they were sort of and they were kind of sniffing around the same time, but it was really but Adobe was the more natural fit.
So you've been within Adobe now for
about 2.5 years.
Two and a half years.
Little more than 2.5 years.
What have you taken from Adobe's culture, way of operating, that I don't know, if you were to run it back with another startup in the future, just something that you've uniquely learned from working within it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that I'm super grateful for the experience of, you know, of working at Adobe. I think it's a really great company. But, you know, I think the key takeaway is, and granted, I'm not running Adobe, so, you know, it's not like I have the same purview of running Frame versus running Adobe, but, you know, I got a seat at the table. I'm in a lot of the important meetings and a lot of the exec meetings. I was reporting directly into Scott, I was reporting into the E team, the executive team. Point being, I've had some purview, and my experience is that it's not that different. And if anything, it's all the same stuff. It's a lot of the same problems. Of course, the bigger the company grows, the nature of them change a little bit, but the problem solving is kind of the same. And it's funny, something Scott said to me during our early walks is, you know, he's like, you know, Adobe's a giant company. It's over 20,000 people, but at the end of the day, it's still just five people in a room making decisions. And that's true, you know? So if anything, I think it's given me maybe more comfort or confidence that, I don't know, I guess I think I could do that.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem that different.
What's that Steve Jobs quote that, you look around the world and, anything you see is created by people no smarter than you or something?
Yeah.
When you get into these big companies and you meet these people, it's...
I think...
They're normal people.
Yeah, I think they're normal people, and I think what I'm about to say is not... It's not indicative. It's... You know, in many ways, the jobs that people have at startups are a lot harder. There's a lot more responsibility. And, you know, at startups, I think that, you know, just naturally the scope of responsibility can be much more narrow.
at big companies.
They can be at big companies, more, sorry. At big companies, the scope of responsibility can be much more narrow. And you know, so I think that, like, I don't know, I'd like to maybe have somebody have the opportunity. I'll come back on and tell you after I've run a 20,000 person company, like, is it any harder? But, you know, from, I think in some ways startups can be a lot harder.
Adobe spent a lot of time thinking about AI. I'm sure you have as well. There's been a mm-hmm. number of different tools that have come out, related to video, generative video. There's So Rare from, OpenAI, Runway. Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff related to that category that seems to be coming out. Any high-level thoughts? I know you've tweeted a little bit about different things related to AI. Being in the creative world, working with design tooling, it sort of feels like you're in the eye of the storm to some extent. What's your purview or perspective?
On, like, how it's going to impact the creative world?
Yeah, just in general. Any thoughts, observations?
I think predicting the future is really hard, and I don't proclaim to be able to do it, but, you know, I think we're a couple generations away from seeing how truly impactful, you know, kind of video generation, you know, can be for the creative industry. You know, you it's certainly potent enough to be involved in, like, a creative process, and you can, you know, sort of do a shot, you know, you can generate a clip and use it as a B-roll or whatever, but it's still, you know, it's still tricky to kind of guide it. And when you get into really, like, what, you know, like, professional creative workflows, I mean, there's a lot of intention around what they're trying to create. And I think that, you know, AI is, it's hard to, I think everyone's trying to work on controllability. Like, how do you sort of steer this thing? Because it's obviously incredibly powerful. But I mean, not speaking for Adobe, I think of, like, over the next few years, it's like, I don't know if it's 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, but there's clearly going to be a day where it's probably not so far off that you can really just, like, input a script and output a movie and probably be as good as, like, great movies. And how does that change the landscape of creativity? I don't know.
Does it lend itself to more, I mean, I guess inevitably it will lend itself to more taste in some ways, and more, like, back to the original point around what motivates you, design and some of those considerations, as the functional skills maybe get up-leveled in a more meaningful way?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. Taste is, you know, I think in an AI, in a kind of a Gen AI world, taste becomes, you know, a more important skills than creation. There's a lot of people that have the technical skill to create, but, you know, maybe their taste is lacking. And if you can put these tools in the hands of people who have great taste, you know, I think that'll be fun to watch. And you know, back to, like, great things in general come from a framework where you have one person driving really clear vision, and then, you know, lots of contribution from other people. And, you know, movies are really, really hard to make. I mean, it is a shocking number of people that have to collaborate. And, you know, movies do have, like culturally, it's about, like, a director driving a vision, but still there's just so many people that have to, you know, come in and be part of that to make a movie happen. And it's so expensive that your ability to iterate or fix something that didn't work well, like, just doesn't really exist. You can't really do that. So when you get to the point where you have a tool that one person's mind can guide and, you know, create a story around and iterate basically for free until they can find what they love, I, you know, maybe the best, you know, maybe we'll have some of the best content we've ever had, because you'll have absolute clarity of vision. It'll cost nothing to iterate and explore different ideas. And, I think we're going to see a ton of cool stuff.
Is there anyone from the outside in that was particularly influential to the business or the outcome? Anyone you would want to shout out or give credit to?
I will say that I had a really awesome board. You know, I think that startups go through tons of problems, and for many startups, board problems are one of them. And I just never had board problems.
You had Voss from Excel,
Voss from Excel, Amish from First Mark, and Itai, who was a board partner on behalf of Insight, but now has his own fund, LGVP, Itai Sidon. But those were my three board members. And for a long time, it was just Voss and Amish. And I also had Chris from Signal Fire. He was a board observer. He was also involved from, but all of them, you know, I think that I really heavily leaned on my board. And I think there's a lot of conversations around like how much value add do investors bring. And I don't know, I thought they brought a ton of value, because for me as a first time founder, they really had just like didn't know a lot about business, especially when it came to really thinking about like, how do we, you know, how do we think about capitalizing the business, setting, you know, success milestones, you know, scaling a sales organization, thinking about like, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff I did wind up talking to the board with was on the, you know, kind of the business side. Mm-hmm. The product side I always drove instinctually, but I mean, I thought they were invaluable.
Was there anything you did in selecting them that was purposeful or
no.
Lucky?
I was lucky.
Yeah.
I was lucky. I think I was lucky. Yeah. I mean, I'd say that for our seed round, we had a competitive seed round, and I wound up choosing Voss from Excel. And I think I chose Voss because he did seem to like just truly get the Frame.io value proposition the best. There's, you know, there's the term founder market fit. I think there's also like investor company fit, you know, in terms of like who really understand, like he really understood it. He was an investor in Envision.
Yep.
Which was, Envision was similar to Frame. They were kind of like, you know, Frame for design, and Envision was ahead of us by a few years.
And Amish was as well, right?
Was as well. So I Envision was a great company that kind of like set a path for us. It can be so much easier when there's a company that's kind of like proven something out, you know, and I think we had a lot to prove in our market because, you know, there wasn't, you know, video collaboration like didn't exist, and kind of the review and approval market was like pretty nascent, but Envision had at least charted a path for us and proven like this space can be valuable. So yeah, Voss and Amish were both on the Envision board, and they were on our board. But I think that what it meant was when I would speak to them, they really got it. They really understood it. So, and they're both great SaaS investors,
yeah,
both great B2B investors. They work well together. That's important too, is like, you know, there's like the board dynamics of like, do your board like each other? Because you might like all of them, but they don't like each other. And that can create, you know, tension. So I never had any board problems. The only time I had a little bit of tension with my board was during acquisition. And that was because there was one board member that was really playing his fiduciary responsibility to like, you know, maximize the outcome. And there was a little bit of disagreement on like when we should like continue to push on the negotiation, where I felt I had pushed, like I was on the front line of negotiating. So I had all the, you know, kind of
easy for the armchair quarterback to say you should push harder.
Yeah. And I felt like, you know, I really knew what the limit was of the pushing, and so anyway, but
in retrespect, I guess,
but it's fine. That was just like a little moment.
Yeah.
Small little moment.
So if nothing purposeful in retrospect, if you were giving advice to someone and picking a board member, picking an investor, would you probe on how deep they can go into the space and how unique their actual interest is in the space? Would you just spend more time with them and get the vibe check and really pin that down?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, I think that especially for all board members, it's not dissimilar to hiring, you know, an executive. Like, I think it's super important that you like each other.
Yeah.
You know, like if you don't want to go to dinner with that person, this very much applies to hiring executives. And it's something that I kind of came around to a little bit later, because you think that like, you don't have to be friends. Like, that's not what it's about to like work with someone. I think you kind of do.
Yeah.
I think you have to like each other enough where like there's some level of enjoyment of spending time with each other. And I call that a friend, you know? And I'm not super, I don't like hang with my employees a lot. I'm not like friends, but you do have to like each other. And I think that's important for the board. Like, you got to like each other. I think their conviction in your space, their understanding of the space, I think really, really does matter. And then I think you want to understand, you know, like talk to other founders and hopefully founders that have, it's probably much more valuable to talk to founders that, you know, of companies that did not succeed or went through some moment of crisis and understand how the board would, you know, respond to that. We did go through one moment of crisis where I had to like, I think was a, you know, the wrong board maybe would have led to, I can't talk about the moment of crisis, but it was, I think the wrong board would have maybe led to a different outcome. And it all turned out to be totally fine because we had a good board. So, you know, it is a marriage.
Marriage with not necessarily the recourse of divorce, I guess.
Yeah.
It's hard to divorce your board.
Yeah. Members. Also, I think, you know, I've heard like other founders where you have like a board member, they're out of fund and like, you sort of don't think about it, but like, they leave the fund they're at and then you're sort of like given over to somebody else or whatever. I mean, I think kind of understanding where they're at in their careers and, you know, their intentions of, I mean, I don't know you can really like learn that much by asking because whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But I think it's good to sort of maybe have a conversation around that and think about it. I think the seniority of the person kind of does matter. It matters. I think the seniority of the person matters. There's probably some people that are not as senior that are just as helpful running the business, but the seniority matters in terms of like, let's leverage on being able to get stuff done for future rounds, whether it's them doing a round or helping you do, you know, a round with somebody else or however you construct that. Voss was particularly, Voss was actually kind of early in his career when we started working together. He was pretty young, but, one of the things that Voss did do is we worked together on every single fundraising round. We worked together on every single pitch deck. We built every pitch deck together. Every single one. I mean, I would go to his house and we'd sit down at his table and, you know, and go through the pitch and rewrite the pitch and practice the pitch. He was particularly helpful on pitching.
Well, good. Well, Emery, thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
This was fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining this episode of the Logan Bartlett Show with co-founder and CEO of Frame, Emery Wells. If you enjoyed this discussion, we'd like for you to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on, as well as share with anyone else that you think might find it interesting. We look forward to seeing you here next week on another great episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Have a good weekend, everyone.